It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Welcome to episode 858. Of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Dynasty Sunday, April 21st, 2024. I am the Solo Monster. Tonight is the first ever AEW Dynasty pay-per-view. I'm going to be going over predictions for the show. We'll run down the entire card. We got a ton of WWE news, including my thoughts for the 2024 draft, which kicks off on SmackDown this upcoming Friday. We got a Dark Side of the Ring review for the gentleman who was anything but Chris Adams, and then some of your questions as well. So let's get into it here, not waste too much time, as is the case on these pay-per-view Sundays, because we got a lot to do. I want to say thank you to everybody who donated via PayPal this week. You may do so on thesolomonster.com. You will find the PayPal link at the top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out, but you already knew that. Shout-out to Big B, Bryant Becerra, the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Paul, thank you, my friend. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soap, the Chicago Screamer, Ian Noel Camelotes, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Brian Man of the Hour, Musha, Best in the Game, Trey Porter, the Pastor of Pain, Damian Ewell, happy birthday, brother, Travon the Cannon Clark, have fun at the Yankee game tomorrow. He's going to his first Yankee game. Travon's been with me since the SE Scoops days. That's how far he goes back. I recently mentioned a cool mobile game called Modern Mania Wrestling GM. It's a pro wrestling general manager game for your phone or tablet, and it's damn good at it. I know some of you checked it out. Now it's time for you to check it out if you have not already done so. This thing is a hidden gem. I got it on my phone. It's a fun game to pick up when I have some downtime here and there. It's easy to pick up and play once you get everything set up. It's got a lot of really cool illustrated characters. The premise is simple. You collect cards for wrestlers, match types, venues, skits, and then you use these cards to book wrestling shows. And I said it last time, it's like your own personal edition of Be the Booker. That's really what it is. The better shows you book, the more in-game cash you earn to collect more cards. So if you team up the right wrestlers and you unlock their tag team card, match certain wrestlers against each other, and you'll unlock their feud card. You can create factions, you can compete with other promotions, or you can control them and see how good of a job you can do managing your own roster. It's a lot of fun, and even better, it's free to play, and the game is constantly being updated with new characters and new features. So just search for Modern Mania Wrestling GM in the App Store or the Google Play Store, and this is the most important part. I want you to pay very close attention. Once you have played through the tutorial, you'll want to head to the settings menu. In the bottom right corner, you will see a code button. That's where you can enter the promo code SOLOMONSTER to unlock a bunch of free wrestlers and game cash, exclusive for Sound Off fans. So pick up your phone and get started. Search for Modern Mania Wrestling GM, and you too can be the booker. This thing is a lot of fun, so make sure you check that out. Let's start with AEW and Dynasty. Tony Khan held a Dynasty media call on Thursday, and credit to PW Insider for help with some of the transcriptions. One of the things that came up in the call and that Tony Khan acknowledged and leaned into is the $2 billion valuation by Forbes that came out on Thursday, and he claimed that AEW is the most valuable sports startup since the AFL, which eventually merged with the NFL, which is not to say that he has any plans of merging AEW with WWE. He's made that pretty clear. That's not in the cards. But he said the upcoming media rights deal is the most important thing for the company, and that pay-per-view growth is also important. And it goes without saying, I mean, I've been saying it, but it goes without saying that, yes, that is true. The media rights deal that Tony Khan is going to make in these next few months is of the utmost importance to the health and future of his company. And it's going to dictate you know, whether or not they can go out and continue to be competitive for free agents and how many people they can sign and other things they can do, depending on how much money they're able to bring in. But Mike Ohzanian has actually said, now he's the reporter with Forbes. He actually said the $2 billion valuation for AEW is likely a minimum number. Now he tweeted this 7 months ago. This is not some new revelation. This is what he said on Twitter 7 months back. So Forbes ran a story this week by Ohzanian and Justin Teitelbaum, both of whom are sports business analysts, regarding the most valuable combat sports franchises in the world. And they listed WWE and AEW on the list behind only the UFC. So in first place, they have the UFC valued at $11.3 billion. WWE is number two at $6.8 billion. AEW is number three at $2 billion. And then after that, it's a bunch of MMA and boxing promotions that go all the way down to number 10, which is Combate Global at $120 million. Now, as far as how he arrived or how they arrived at this $2 billion valuation, I'm not sure. Obviously, it's an educated guess based on whatever information is publicly available. And they probably also looked at the market value of some of the other organizations on the list, and they determined that AEW is valued at least $2 billion. Doesn't mean that it's a hard and solid figure. Look, think about it like this. And Bellator is, not on this list, but Bellator, okay, the MMA promotion, at one time was valued to be worth as much as $500 million. A couple of years later, you know what Bellator sold for? Sold for less than $100 million. And that was in stock, not cash. Valuations are not an exact science. They may be factoring in a possible media rights increase. That would be my guess, that they're factoring that in. It's kind of baked into the number. And I do think they are getting an increase. But it's a private company, and there's no way to know for sure how accurate any of these numbers really are. Other than Tony Khan always talks in very glowing terms about everything being up. And he's the president and CEO of the company, so I can understand him being rosy in all of the things that he says. But, you know, with him, everything's great. Everything's up. Everything's coming up aces. And do we know for sure? No, we don't, because it's a private company. It may be worth $2 billion. It may not be worth $2 billion. But I'm sure he loved leaning into that once Forbes published that story this week. Now, he was also asked about the criticism to airing the brawl-in footage with CM Punk and Jack Perry the week before. And he was asked whether he understands the criticism that he has gotten from a lot of fans online about airing the footage. And this was his response. It felt like when TBS called me and told me, good job, you have to remember that I'm responsible for everybody's jobs in this company. And it is really important for us to please the network, and TBS was really happy with that show and that performance. That's the most important part. Important thing, and our fan feedback on the show that we got, you know, the rating is the number one source of fan feedback in the end of the network, and they were incredibly pleased. It was over 400,000 viewers in the 18 to 49 demographic, and that was a strong performance. And that is how TBS judges the show. It is the most important metric I have for the performance, and then the fan reception. Last night we had an amazing crowd. The fans were rabid. They were really excited. They were red hot, in particular for that match involving the Young Bucks. FTR got a big chance, and I think people are really excited to see the Young Bucks teaming up this weekend with Okada to take on Pac and FTR and get a preview of that big ladder match at Dynasty. I am very much, he has completely now veered into, he's very good, very good or very bad, I guess, depending on how you look at it, in just completely either not answering a question or giving you an answer, but then just completely transitioning into something different than what the person asked. But anyway, he says it was a good thing that they did. That's basically the nuts and bolts of it. I read what he's saying there, and to me, that doesn't paint the best picture for his company. If he felt the need to air that footage because he felt he needed to do something to make TBS happy, because they were coming off weeks of ratings declines, right? It was pretty transparent why they did what they did when they did it. Okay, if CM Punk does not go and talk to Ariel Helwani, this footage does not air that week, you cannot convince me otherwise. I don't care if Jack Perry was on his way back or not. That footage does not air if CM Punk does not go and talk about Brawl In and AEW and call Tony Khan a clown and all of the other things that he said. But where are the people who, when the Dynamite ratings come in, and I don't even talk about the WWE ratings and the AEW ratings much anymore anyway, because they're all pretty much in the same range. You know, AEW's ratings were down this week, which was predictable because there was no CM Punk footage for them to air. So, of course, they were back down. But where are these AEW stans that I see on social media who will always come out and say, ratings don't matter. Ratings, they barely matter anymore. Why does everybody talk about the ratings? Can't we just talk about how great the wrestling is and how great the shows are? Why is everybody so hung up on the ratings? Well, this is why. Because you have the president of the company going out and saying that this is their most important metric. He is flat out saying that the ratings are the most important metric they use to judge performance of his television show. So which is it? Because you're hearing a lot of conflicting things from Tony Khan and from the fans of his promotion who love to always harp on about how the ratings don't matter. The ratings may not matter in the way they mattered 25 years ago during the Monday Night War, but if you think the ratings don't matter, you're a fucking idiot. But in something that would bode very well for AEW, there was another piece of news this week. CNBC is reporting that the NBA's exclusive media rights negotiating window with Disney and Warner Brothers Discovery is likely to expire on Monday, that's tomorrow, without a new deal. Now, should the NBA not work out a new deal to stay with Warner, and they still could, it's still possible that they will reach some kind of a deal, but if they don't, that would leave an awfully big hole in their programming schedule. And that makes AEW more valuable right at the time where Tony Khan is still in that exclusive negotiating window with them and trying to work out a new deal. I'm not saying that AEW is going to, on its own, replace the NBA. I mean, that's laughable. But if the NBA goes away and they don't have that to rely on anymore, I'm just saying it does make AEW more valuable to Warner Brothers Discovery. Now, on the statement, and then we'll wrap up with the Tony Khan portion here, on the statement that CM Punk made that AEW did not pay for his medical procedure. This was after he tore his tricep the first time in Chicago in the All Out match with Jon Moxley. Tony was asked about that. And if it is their normal procedure to pay for or not pay for these things if people get hurt in their ring, he said, I'd have to look into that. I can't say for sure. It doesn't sound right to me. If that is the case, you know, then I would reimburse them. Honestly, I didn't think that was the case, and it doesn't sound right. So I would have to look into that. You know, that's a good question. But typically, we do cover those medical expenses, especially for something that occurred in the ring as that did. So I would have to look into that. But no, I'm not sure about that. I can't say for sure. This is in reference to what CM Punk said to Ariel Helwani on the MMA Hour. Punk said, nobody in the company spoke to me for 6 months. I paid for my surgery, booked my surgery. Thankfully, Doc Samson, who I knew from WWE and had a good rapport with, he helped me with that. But I was on my own with all that stuff. If you think I deserve to be fired or treated like that, that's your opinion. It's none of my business what you think of me. The recovery for this one, and he's talking about the current triceps injury that he's out with, compared to the recovery for that one, it's night and day. It's almost the comparison between places where there's structure, there's protocols, and there's professional people in charge of things. And I'm not having to research and find a PT spot. I had no help, nothing. That's insane to me. Is that how they treat the Jaguars players? I don't know. I don't think anyone should be treated like that if you're a professional athlete. I had no help. Nobody would speak to me. Now, you can't tell me that Tony Khan clearly watched the interview that Punk did with Ariel. Okay, he was said to be very upset about it. Oh, I'm sure he was. Okay, he obviously watched the interview, as evidenced by the fact that a week later he aired the Brawl In footage on TV. There is no way that he did not watch that interview or hear everything that Punk said about him and his company, and yet here, and how many weeks later, is 2 weeks later now, he acts like this is the first that he's hearing of it. So he either knows or would have looked into it already the minute that Punk made the claim. Just sounds to me like he's playing dumb here. Either way, he should have knowledge of whether or not the company reimbursed this man. Now, if Punk got hurt on his watch, in his ring, which he did, in Tony Khan's own words, he got hurt in the ring, in the match, with Jon Moxley, not in the back, then Tony Khan should pay for the surgery and have somebody following up with this guy, whether he's on suspension or not. I'm going back to when the thing first happened. You want to give him the silent treatment. I know that whole thing was a fucking embarrassment, but you got to follow up with the guy, whether he's suspended or not, to make sure he's getting the care that he needs if he got hurt on your watch. And if that didn't happen, then that's wrong. Plain and simple. Tonight is AEW Dynasty on pay-per-view. I'm going to run through the card here with some predictions. So we'll start with the zero-hour pre-show, which kicks off, I want to say it's 7 Eastern tonight. I assume it's an 8 p.m. start time for the pay-per-view. I'm sure it'll be a four-hour show, as it usually is. We have Orange Cassidy and Katsuyori Shibata taking on Shane Taylor and Lee Moriarty. I got Cassidy and Shibata going over here. I know Shane Taylor promotions is a thing on TV right now, and Shane Taylor is an impressive guy. Doesn't win very often. I don't see that changing tonight, so Cassidy and Shibata go over. We have Trent Beretta, who recently turned on Orange Cassidy, taking on Matt Sydal. He threw a chair at Sydal's head on Wednesday's Dynamite when Matt Sydal tried to come out and assist Orange Cassidy from a post-match attack by Shane Taylor Promotions. So Trent Beretta will get the win here. Obviously, they're building to a match between him and OC. And the third match on the zero-hour pre-show is Billy Gunn and the Acclaimed taking on Jay White and the Guns. This is winner-take-all for the AEW Trios Championship and the Ring of Honor six-man tag team titles. On the media call, Tony Khan clarified, he said the winner of this match will be the undisputed World Trios Champions. He says, I think that's very cool, and it'll create a lot of great opportunities for the top trios out there. I think it's very exciting. Some consolidation and unification of championships. Yeah, it's about time. That is the correct move. Do you realize, I didn't even realize this, but I was curious. Billy Gunn and the Acclaimed have not defended the AEW Trios title since January 24th. April 24th is coming up in a few days. Ridiculous. I'm not even going to sit here and say that those belts are that much more valuable than the Ring of Honor ones, but the Ring of Honor belts don't mean shit. This is something that should have happened a long time ago. So long as they have the Ring of Honor six-man champions parading around on AEW television, you don't need two sets of trios belts. This should be a win for Jay White and the Guns. I mean, this should be the easiest thing in the world to book right here. You have Jay White pin Billy Gunn. The one thing he could not do on television a few weeks ago, which was ridiculous. You make up for that. You have him pin Billy Gunn, Jay White and the Guns. They walk out of here, undisputed trios champions. You get rid of the Ring of Honor belts, and that's the end of that. Now we get into the main card. We have Hook defending the FTW championship against Chris Jericho. Does anybody not think that Jericho isn't going to walk out with the FTW title? I'd be very surprised if Jericho does not add that title to his resume tonight. I got Chris Jericho going over. Not that I want to see Chris Jericho go over, but I see him going over. We have Adam Copeland, Eddie Kingston, and Mark Briscoe teaming up to take on the House of Black. I've got Copeland, Kingston, and Briscoe for the win. International title on the line. Roderick Strong defends against Kyle O'Reilly. He turned on Kyle on Collision last weekend, and so this should be a hell of a match. I don't see a title change, though, so I see Roddy retaining. We have Kazuchika Okada putting his AEW Continental title on the line against Pac. Again, on paper, there's no less than four matches, maybe five, on this show that could potentially steal the entire thing. Like, on paper, this is a very strong card. This match right here is one of the reasons why. Okada and Pac is going to be awesome. There's no chance that Okada loses this title, so I have him going over. We have Julia Hart, who apparently in the odds is the favorite coming into this, which surprised me. She's defending the TBS title against Willow Nightingale. Julia may or may not be dealing with a shoulder injury. I know there was some speculation last week she may have hurt her shoulder. She was on TV this past week. I don't think she really did much, although I have not caught up with Collision last night. But either way, I have Willow Nightingale going over here because the winner of this match is going to defend the TBS title in Las Vegas at Double or Nothing against Mercedes Moné. Mercedes is not wrestling until May 26th. And that will be her first match. And in her very first match, she is getting a TBS title shot. And I think the match is Willow and Mercedes. That's the match that makes more sense. That's the match I'd rather see. So I have Willow Nightingale winning the TBS title tonight. Then we have the finals of the tag team title tournament. We're going to have new AEW World Tag Team Champions crowned. The Young Bucks take on FTR in a ladder match. And the winners will become the first three-time AEW Tag Team Champions. I do think tonight is going to be the return of the scapegoat, Jack Perry, to AEW television. I believe he has wrapped up with New Japan. It just makes sense, you know, especially with the ladder stipulation. All he needs to do is show up. He can tip the ladder over at the exact right moment. Young Bucks pull down the belts. Young Bucks are going to be your new tag team champions. Jack Perry probably joining them in the Elite with Okada. We have Toni Storm defending the AEW Women's World title against Thunder Rosa. It was a great promo from Toni Storm on Collision that was floating around on social media. She still had all the lipstick smeared all over her face that Rosa, you know, Rosa just smeared it all over her face on Wednesday. And she wanted it to stay on while she cut this promo, and it was actually really good. Thunder Rosa, she's a fine opponent for Toni Storm. I am not expecting a title change here. I think that would be ridiculous. You know, when you have this story still playing out with Mariah May, why would you take that title off of Toni now? So Toni Storm will retain. And then we have the two main events, and it really is two main events on this show. In one case, you have for the first time ever, Will Ospreay, one-on-one against Bryan Danielson. Bryan Danielson is someone who some would consider maybe to be the greatest wrestler of all time, bell to bell. Certainly he would be, if not the greatest, one of the greatest wrestlers of the last 20 years. Inarguably, he is on that list. He is at the top of that list. If he's not number one, he's number two. And then on the other side, we have Will Ospreay, who some people, myself included, would consider the best wrestler in the world right now, bell to bell. When that bell rings and he goes in there, the things that he does and the way that he can bring the crowd into it too, really from the moment he comes out, you know, he's a special talent. Ospreay, just, he's been tearing it up now for years. Almost doesn't even matter who you put him in the ring with. All those great matches in New Japan, the matches he's had so far in AEW, even going back to last year against Kenny at Forbidden Door, but the match with Takeshita, the television matches he's had against Fletcher, and I mean, this guy's incredible. He had the match he had with Claudio on TV on Wednesday. If that's what he's doing in the ring with Claudio on TV, what do you think he'll do in there with Bryan Danielson tonight? Very much looking forward to this match. More than any other on the card, this is going to be a win for Will Ospreay. Will Ospreay is on a trajectory right now to Wembley, I believe to the AEW World Championship by the end of this summer. And to get there, he's got to rack up big wins against big names. And Bryan Danielson is one of the biggest names in the company that he could beat. And then we have Swerve Strickland in the main event, the match that is closing the show, I do believe, challenging Samoa Joe for the AEW World Heavyweight Championship. Many months ago on TV, Swerve said that he is going to become the first ever black AEW World Champion. That was a promise that he made. That comes true tonight. It feels right. It feels like the right time. Revolution did not. Revolution, the focus was all on Sting. It was Sting. It was Sting's retirement. Samoa Joe, I felt, deserved a little more time. I thought maybe get him at least a Double or Nothing. Originally, I saw this as the Double or Nothing main event, and I thought you'd do the title change in Vegas. But they're doing the match here. They could do a finish that necessitates a rematch. I mean, they may do a rematch anyway, even if they do a title change. We may get Joe getting his rematch at Double or Nothing. But now it feels like this is the right time. Especially if they're going to headline and close the show with this. It's Swerve's moment. You know, Swerve may never be more over than he is right now. right? He's one of the more over baby faces in the entire company. The fans feel like they are ready to embrace him in this spot. He has earned this spot. I have Swerve Strickland going over and winning the AEW World title. I think Samoa Joe is a great champion. I just love the way he carries himself, and he's been having good matches. And part of me hates to take the title off of him this soon, and maybe they can get it back on him again at some point. Although I kind of look at this, and it does kind of feel to me like this may be it as far as his big run as world champion. This could be the last time we see it, but Swerve's the guy. Swerve's the right guy at the right time. He may not become Wembley, so I think Ospreay's going to get it, which is, I think, part of the reason why you want to get Swerve in now. Not that he can't win the belt back and have a second run with it, but that first run, he deserves at least a few months, right? A few challengers, a few months before he drops it. So I have Swerve going over. And that's the card. Again, on paper, it looks fantastic, but I'm sure it'll be a late night. Join me live on YouTube when it's over for the full recap tonight. One more piece of AEW news here. This comes per Cassidy Haynes of BodySlam.net. He reported earlier in the week that the Motor City Machine Guns, Alex Shelley and Chris Sabin, who became free agents as of April 1st when their TNA contracts expired, they are on their way in to All Elite Wrestling. And after speaking to sources, he says he can confirm that they are headed there. They're working on finalizing a deal. At least as of the beginning of the week, it was not yet final. Maybe at this point, as of this morning, it is. But he said it won't be finalized for a little while. But the decision was made. The deal is all but done, and they are on their way in. I am not surprised by this news at all. It did feel like AEW probably would be the best fit. I would have loved to have seen them in the tag division in WWE against those teams, against New Day, against Imperium, against the Creeds. I think they could have had a good run there. I think that Triple H probably has a lot of respect for them. I mean, he did bring Shelley in briefly for a couple of appearances in NXT many years ago to tag with Kushida. Sabin has never worked there. You know, but they're veterans. They've been doing this for well over 20 years. They can still go. They're an incredible tag team. In AEW, though, that style, it just seems to be a better fit. And if the Young Bucks walk out with the tag team titles tonight, it may just be that the Machine Guns walk in. You know, and the Machine Guns could be, if not right away, in pretty short order, they could be wrestling the Young Bucks, you know, for those tag team titles. So whenever that may be, that is going to be a big pickup for the tag team division in AEW.
Hey, it's Chris Van Vliet. And after this episode of Solo Monster Sounds Off, check out my podcast. It's called Insight with Chris Van Vliet. All of my interviews that you might have seen on YouTube are all available in audio form. We've got two new guests every week on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and some recent episodes include Becky Lynch, John Cena, Dustin Rhodes, Samantha Irvin, Bobby Roode, and Chelsea Green, just to name a few. Listen to Insight with Chris Van Vliet wherever you get your podcasts.
On Friday night, while SmackDown was in progress, WWE released five talents due to what Fightful says was listed internally as budget cuts. Former WWE champion Jinder Mahal, Veer and Sangha of Indushare, who Jinder had been managing, Xia Li, and NXT star Zion Quinn are all gone from the company. A bad day for wrestlers with the letter X in their name. Xavier Woods better turn his phone off. Jinder tweeted that he quit, but Fightful and PW Insider confirmed that he was released. You know, look, unless he requested his release previously and they only granted it now, of course he was released. He didn't happen to quit the same day that four other people just so happened to be released. Now, he already has free agent 90 days in his bio, 90 days before Tony Khan brings him in to work with Hook. 12 years, though, Jinder spent with WWE. There was a brief gap in the middle after he got released the first time. He held the WWE Championship for 6 months, 170 days, which included two pay-per-view title defenses against Shinsuke Nakamura, the same year that Nakamura got called up to the main roster. He could not even beat Jinder Mahal. He was pretty much finished at that point, as far as somebody that you could look at and say, okay, this guy's going to be a champion one day. He was pretty much done before he even got started on the main roster. Now, Nakamura, he did get a WrestleMania match the following year with AJ Styles for the title. Couldn't win that either. Then he and AJ had three more matches on pay-per-view for a total of four. Four title matches on pay-per-view in 2018 for those two. And he came out of those winless, all of them. And still, you know there are people who think that Nakamura could still get that elusive run with the title at least once before he retires. These people are delusional. Nakamura may never be able to say that he was WWE champion, but Jinder Mahal can. Now, he disappeared for a while, and then he reappeared as the manager for Indushare, and a segment with The Rock on day one. That was the day one episode of Raw. Then he got a World Heavyweight Championship match a few weeks later with Seth Rollins, and he lost. And that was it for him. They clearly were not going to do anything with this guy, so this was not a surprise. And frankly, I think he could probably do well for himself on the independent scene. If Jinder Mahal is a go-getter, if Jinder Mahal doesn't want to be sitting in the back on his ass doing nothing, if Jinder Mahal wants to be working, then this is the best thing for him. Because now he'll be free in 90 days. I'm sure he won't have a problem getting bookings. And he'll be able to go out there and work. And up his stock again. Because his stock was going nowhere, sitting in the back doing nothing. Or being a manager. So if the guy wants to work, if he wants to wrestle, then this was probably a blessing in disguise. Veer and Sangha, not a huge surprise on them either being released, which is too bad because they were doing character work with Sangha when he was in NXT. And maybe, I'm not saying that it was all great. He was a babyface and he was doing, like yoga. It was something out of his element. But he was starting to show more personality. He was doing more character stuff. I thought they had something in the guy. Then they called him up and he played the typical brute character who never spoke. And then they never even tried to do anything different with him. He just was like the silent enforcer type who came out. You know, they put him in a team. I guess they just felt maybe in the ring he wasn't progressing. But I feel like it was kind of a waste they didn't do more with him. Xia Li was very complimentary to the company in her farewell message. She spent 7 years there. She was their first female Chinese star. They produced these really well-done comic book-like vignettes for her when they called her up. She made one or two appearances on TV, and then she was rarely ever used. She had a gimmick where she was the protector. She was the protector of SmackDown. Something would happen to a babyface on the show, she would come out, she was there. Like Seth Rollins as the shield for Cody Rhodes. She was the protector. And then one day they just inserted a backstage vignette into the show. Not even a vignette, a backstage promo where she said, you know what, from now on, I don't want to be the protector anymore. Instead, she became the protector of catering. You could blame Vince McMahon for losing interest in her, but it's not as if things were much better under Triple H. If they were, guess what? She'd be on television right now instead of on the unemployment line. I don't think she ever got a fair shake. And to invest 7 years into somebody and not at least try, it just seems like a complete waste. Zion Quinn was an Australian talent. He signed with them in 2018. He debuted on NXT in 2020. Didn't do much. Then they drafted him as a free agent. He went undrafted as a free agent. And his two appearances on the main roster consisted of a battle royal on Raw almost a year ago, and a six-second loss to Bron Breakker on SmackDown. He's been a dead man walking for a while now. He had a good look, but from what I saw, there just wasn't a whole lot there. None of these names are surprising to me. Sue Aitchison being let go last week in The Office was more surprising to me than any of these names. NBC News published a story about Vince McMahon this week. Vince McMahon's life after WWE. And the title of the story was Kittens, Vacations, and Staying in Touch with Trump. It says NBC News and CNBC talked to 11 people familiar with McMahon in WWE about how he has been spending his time. I get questions from people about sometimes on Twitter, like, what do you think Vince McMahon is up to? What do you think he's doing? What do you think his day-to-day life is like? And honestly, I don't spend much time thinking about it. But if you wanted your answer, here's your answer. It says these people, including close personal associates and company insiders, declined to be named, citing ongoing legal cases and the confidential nature of internal corporate communications. Multiple WWE insiders said he has not had any contact with company leaders and figureheads since he resigned. Mark Shapiro, the operating chief of WWE's parent company TKO, said in March that McMahon doesn't work for the company, doesn't come into the office, and he is not coming back to the company. That also means McMahon has not talked to his son-in-law, WWE creative chief and former star Paul Triple H Levesque, or daughter Stephanie McMahon Levesque regarding company matters, according to sources. Now, of course, how would anybody know what they have talked about if they see him? If he's going, and I'm not even sure how much, honestly, how much contact this man even has with his family at this point. I don't know how often he's around Triple H and Stephanie. I don't know how often or the last time he saw his grandkids. But let's assume that there's at least some contact between them. Maybe they get together for dinner every now and then. How are we going to know that Triple H and Vince don't talk shop about WWE, right? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But like when they're technically family and they can get together privately as family, the answer is nobody knows how much discussion there has been between the two sides when it comes to business. I would like to think that they've cut him off as far as that goes, and they don't talk to him about WWE stuff. But the answer is nobody knows. Says McMahon is nonetheless indelibly linked with the wrestling company, which he bought from his father 42 years ago. Still, he seems to have moved on, according to multiple sources. McMahon was kept has kept up his other routines, and it is as if he is unfazed by his legal fights, two sources said. For instance, on an afternoon in late March, McMahon returned on a private plane to the United States from the sunny Turks and Caicos Islands, but he was not alone, according to a person close to him. He had with him seven kittens and a puppy, all of which he brought back to be adopted by his friends. If anything, this person says, he's enjoying life, who said that McMahon had also taken a trip to Italy. This is according to a person close to him. Ask yourself, who would want to be close to Vince McMahon at this point? There will be no Vince McMahon redemption arc. I don't care how many kittens he brings back. I don't care how many puppies he brings back. He'll probably make them sign an NDA too. The details of McMahon's life after WWE present a stark contrast to Janelle Grant's accusations, which paint a graphic portrait of a violent and controlling man. In her federal lawsuit filed January 25th, Grant's attorney said that she was the victim of physical and emotional abuse, sexual assault, and trafficking at WWE, naming McMahon and former executive John Laurinaitis. Both men have denied accusations in the suit. The lawsuit also named WWE as a defendant. WWE and its parent company TKO have said that they take Grant's allegations very seriously. Federal investigators seized a phone from McMahon and have been trying to determine whether federal law was broken in the conduct surrounding Grant's allegations. WWE had disclosed last summer that investigators served McMahon with a federal grand jury subpoena and executed a search warrant in July. McMahon is cooperating with authorities, according to one of the people close to him. McMahon believes officials won't bring any charges against him and that Grant's civil case will be settled out of court, said a person close to the former wrestling executive. A spokesperson for Grant's attorney said there have been absolutely no settlement talks with McMahon. And that may well be the case, but again, I just feel like in so many of these cases, there usually is a settlement. If the dollar amount is high enough, again, money talks. And if there were crimes committed here, then I hope that they see this through to the end. But it's hard to believe that this won't ultimately end in some kind of a settlement and people not being allowed to say anything beyond that. But we'll see. While his legal battles persist, McMahon is often ferried by a private driver from his posh Connecticut home to Manhattan, according to one of the sources close to him. There, he eats with friends at restaurants such as the old-school Italian spot Il Tonello on 46th Street. I've eaten at that restaurant. He sees his longtime barber for biweekly haircuts and works with his personal trainer multiple times per week. Two other sources, however, say that McMahon has otherwise been quite guarded and often on the phone with his lawyers to map out plans since Grant's lawsuit was made public. McMahon has also talked to Trump. The two billionaires have been in touch regularly, although it is not clear what they have discussed. And then it gets into WrestleMania 40, Stephanie surprising the crowd with an appearance and talking about, you know, her husband, and now it's the Paul Levesque era. It was a significant moment for the brand, coming during the first WrestleMania since the Grant lawsuit, and its first under TKO management. Still, some rank-and-file WWE employees have griped that the company has not done more to address the situation. After McMahon quit, Shapiro told a global town hall for both TKO and Endeavor employees, in no uncertain terms, that the former wrestling boss would not return. Shapiro also assured employees that Levesque and WWE president Nick Khan have his support. Otherwise, WWE is more relaxed since McMahon resigned in January. When McMahon was still running things, he would come in late in the afternoon and often stay until around midnight or beyond. Two current employees said his office at WWE headquarters in Stamford is unoccupied but otherwise intact, according to an executive who called it spooky. He had a reputation for being capricious and quick to fire employees, which generated fear and created a chilling effect. Now there's more levity and freedom to make a mistake or suggest an idea. The current leadership operates more conventionally, giving underperforming employees a standard progress report and opportunities to improve before taking action. Some McMahon loyalists remain, but one employee said, WWE is actually a really great place to work, and Vince distracted from that. It's been much better since he left. Another person said, people feel like they're on steadier ground. Yeah, well, that's what happens when you don't have to work for a raving psychopath anymore. You feel a little less stressed out. The company, meanwhile, is charting its post-McMahon course with the help of lucrative media rights deals. And then it gets into the Friday Night SmackDown deal for USA and the Netflix deal for Raw. And then finally here, there's yet another sign suggesting that McMahon's distance from WWE is more than temporary. He has sold hundreds of millions of dollars worth of shares in TKO since November, a sizable chunk of those sales coming after he resigned in January. That is different from when he briefly stepped down in 2022. And according to one of the insiders, this time it's like, okay, now it's over. Now, the story also has a paragraph where it says that since Vince resigned, he has been in touch with Dwayne The Rock Johnson and John Cena. Now, John Cena is not surprising if you listen to his comments on the Howard Stern show. You know, he still considers Vince a good friend. He's standing by him. A spokesperson for Janelle Grant said it is shameful that Mr. Johnson and Mr. Cena would associate themselves with an individual with decades of allegations just like Janelle's. Behind-the-scenes support is louder than any public statement ever could be. Now, there has been a lot of speculation about Vince McMahon possibly starting up a new wrestling promotion. With all of the stock he's been selling, he's got over $1 billion banked just from those stock transactions, and he has put all of his remaining shares in TKO up for sale as of last week. So he will very soon be completely divested from this company. And you have to ask yourself, why? What is he planning? And I saw Dave Meltzer said that if he wanted to start his own company, he wouldn't be able to until early next year, I think January of 2025, because he has 1 year non-compete. Once the non-compete expires, he's free to do whatever he wants. The man is going to be 79 years old with some of the worst, most depraved allegations hanging over his head. Still on, under investigation also by the federal government. When this deal was made with Endeavor, they literally had statements in their SEC filings calling him a liability and saying that he could do damage to their company. Like, they acknowledged that, and that's going to be the same for any company or any network that he wanted to work with. The man is toxic. He's the toxic Avenger. Even his good buddy, Ari Emanuel, had to cut ties and distance himself from him. And Ari is the one who went on CNBC after the deal was announced last year and said, oh, this whole deal was contingent on Vince being a part of it. I wouldn't have done the deal if my good friend didn't come along for the ride. Now he can't push him away fast enough. He's got plenty of money to start up whatever company he wants, but what television network would want to partner with him? He's not going to start up a company unless he gets TV. There's no point in doing that. You think Vince McMahon is going to run an independent promotion? Are we going to be competing with him out here on the East Coast? What advertisers would want to advertise with this man? What names would want to come work for him? I mean, I guess if you pay somebody enough money, anything's possible. But what big names is he going to lure over to come work for him? WWE and AEW, they pretty much have all the key talent locked up. WWE's got a whole developmental system where they're pulling people out of high school and college. So that's where the future stars are coming from. You know, the wrestling talent pool is not that big, relatively speaking. It really isn't. I don't know what he's going to do. He's not just going to sit quietly in his rocking chair for the rest of his days. But starting a wrestling company would be the easiest way for him to waste all of his money. He may as well throw it all in a big pile and set it on fire, like the Joker in The Dark Knight. Just what the world needs. Another wrestling company run by an 80-year-old alleged rapist and Kevin Dunn brought back as his head of production. Because you know he would. While speaking at the World Congress of Sports Convention on Wednesday in Los Angeles, WWE President Nick Khan gave an update on the company's plans for future PLE locations. He said, "We sat down together a few years ago and decided the Big Five premium live events should be in the United States or Canada. All of the other events, the goal is to have them from international locations." And in the coming months, of course, they have Backlash coming up May 4th in France. They have King and Queen of the Ring next month in Saudi Arabia. Clash at the Castle is on June 15th in Scotland. And Bash in Berlin is coming up on August 31st in Germany. None of which are considered one of their top events. And so you hear this, that would seem to put a dagger in the heart of John Cena's pitch to bring WrestleMania to London. I'm honestly not sure why they sent him out there at Money in the Bank last year to even tease it, if Nick Khan is now saying that they sat down years ago and decided that it was never going to happen. That just seems cruel. Also at the convention, Arash Markazi of the Sporting Tribune, they also brought him in briefly to work for NXT a few years ago as an interviewer. He tweeted, "Khan wasn't ready to announce the location of WrestleMania in 2025 just yet, but he said that you can assume it will not be in an outdoor East Coast stadium again, and it won't go head-to-head with the Final Four again. Las Vegas is one of the cities under consideration," he says. And this, right after Philly just said they wanted to bring WrestleMania back. Oh, well. Literally, just the other day, one of their travel and tourism board executives told the media that they were ready to turn around very soon and have meetings again with WWE about bringing WrestleMania back to the city of brotherly love. Maybe if they put a roof on Lincoln Financial, maybe they'll get them back. Markazi tweeted, "The outdoor East Coast stadium part wasn't surprising. Philadelphia was the last WrestleMania that Khan inherited. Look for future WrestleManias to be held in Super Bowl venues. But moving away from going head-to-head with the Final Four is new. They have gone head-to-head for years." Las Vegas and Minneapolis are the two cities that have been thrown around for a while now. It's going to be one or the other. And whichever one gets 41, the other one would probably end up getting 42. The fact that they did not announce the location for next year's show at this year's show or by this year's WrestleMania, that has me thinking that Minneapolis thought they had it locked down, but they are seriously thinking about going with Las Vegas instead. Las Vegas would be a great destination for a WrestleMania, especially today. I mean, it would be so much bigger than it was in 93 when they had it at Caesar's Palace, you know, and they have a stadium now. Allegiant Stadium is there. Fightful is reporting that there have been discussions of moving WrestleMania to May for the first time. You would think that based on what Nick Khan said, if anything, they would shift the shows back to March, like they used to sometimes do. But May would be a first. I'll tell you what, though, if they want to run outdoor stadiums on the East Coast, May would be better than April. But I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. If they ran a colder city, then sure, I think that makes sense. You know, May would be better. But otherwise, I would just rather see WrestleMania stay right where it is. Rhea Ripley was forced to vacate the Women's World Championship on Raw last Monday due to injury after 380 days as champion. And the injury didn't even happen at WrestleMania. It happened at a backstage segment with Liv Morgan. not from the flying chair to the head, but from Liv throwing Rhea into a wall. She injured her AC joint that connects her collarbone to her right shoulder. It's either a sprained AC joint or a separated AC joint. I've read conflicting reports. How long she will be out for depends on whether she needs surgery, but it must be serious enough if they took the title away from her. I mean, it's not like we haven't had champions recently who don't defend their title for months on end. We saw it with Roman Reigns. We saw it with Logan Paul. And we saw it with Seth Rollins. So the fact that they took the title away from her tells me that they think she's going to be gone for a while. And when you have a dominant champion like that, and you build your division around that person, and then they get hurt, it's a huge blow. It's a huge blow to lose a big star like Rhea Ripley. In a division that does not have many stars to begin with, that makes it even worse. You know, let's not pretend that Rhea Ripley had some incredible run as champion. She hasn't. She's one of the most popular stars in the entire company, male or female. But it has nothing to do with her run as champion, or all the great matches that she's had, or all the great opponents that she's had. When you look at her actual reign, her year as champion, it will go down as one of the least memorable, least impressive women's title runs in at least the last decade. And that has more to do with just how weak the division has been and how poorly they have booked it. And when I say they, I mean Paul Levesque. Since this is the Paul Levesque era, is it not? Right? Not everything he touches turns to gold. Case in point, the women's division. At least on SmackDown, they had the damage control story that they took their time telling. Io Sky's run may have actually been worse than Rhea's. But Rhea had no story. Now she does, with Liv Morgan. When Liv got hurt last year, who did they credit with the injury? Rhea Ripley. So when Liv came back, she was on what she called her revenge tour. She's still on her revenge tour. It says it on her shirt. So as terrible as it is that Rhea got hurt, story-wise, they've got a great one with Liv being the one who injured her. She got her revenge, just like she said she would. Yeah, when she walked out there on Monday night, she was laughing about it, and the fans booed her. Even though she did nothing wrong, she was right in her promo later on when she said that she couldn't understand why the fans were so upset. Where were all you people when I got hurt last year? Says, no, Rhea only got more popular while Liv was gone, so the woman has a point. So the story is great. Liv comes back, injures Rhea, and forces her to vacate her title. The same title that Liv Morgan is probably going to win on Raw tomorrow night. They are holding a battle royal to crown a new women's world champion. It is either going to be Liv Morgan or Nia Jax. And I think Liv Morgan winning the title is the correct choice. Now, I don't like the idea of crowning a new champion in a battle royal tomorrow night. I actually think holding off until the Queen of the Ring tournament next month and crowning a new champion there is what I would have done. I think that would have made that tournament that much more interesting. But they opted not to do it. And holding a separate tournament over these next many weeks, that would have been stupid because they're going to have qualifying matches for Queen of the Ring soon. You're not going to do two women's tournaments back to back. Liv is the most obvious choice, but sometimes the obvious choice is the best choice. You know, the double turn has already started. It started on Monday. The fans were already cheering Rhea and booing Liv anyway. So when Rhea comes back, she's going to go right after Liv Morgan to get her belt back. But the Raw women's division was already in desperate need of an overhaul even before Rhea got hurt. Now she is hurt. Charlotte Flair is still hurt. The draft starts this Friday. Triple H needs to take advantage of that and use it to restock that Raw roster. And I'm going to be talking about the draft in a little bit and how I would do that. Rhea Ripley is not the only one hurt on the Raw brand. It's the walking wounded right now. Seth Rollins will not be doing any walking for a while. He underwent knee surgery on Tuesday to repair a torn meniscus. Becky Lynch announced the news during an interview on a TV show in Ireland that Seth had undergone the surgery. That is the same torn meniscus he suffered in January, where he also tore his MCL, took time off so that he could get cleared in time for WrestleMania. Because he was not missing that show, especially having the chance to get his first real WrestleMania main event. You would have had to cut the man's leg off to stop him from getting that night one main event, and even then he would have dragged himself down the ramp. So he did make it to WrestleMania, and then he went out there, and he wrestled back-to-back matches. the main event of night one for 45 minutes, and the opening match on night two, another 10 minutes with Drew McIntyre. The man was a warrior this year. Give him a lot of credit for that. He called himself the workhorse champion. He wrestled on TV almost every single week. He got hurt in that match with Jinder. Came back. He worked back-to-back nights at WrestleMania. Dropped the world heavyweight title. Did the honors for Drew. Then came back out in the Cody Rhodes-Roman Reigns match to be Cody's shield. I remember saying, you know, in my review, I said, man, Rollins, he looked half dead out there at the end of the show. The way he was moving around, I didn't know if he was just really good at selling or if he was hurt. It was probably a mix of both. But now we know why he looked so terrible, because he was hurt. The man dragged himself out there and did what he had to do. And now he's probably going to miss the next 6 to 9 months, because that's the estimated recovery time for a torn meniscus. I don't even see the point in drafting him. You know, just keep him as a free agent. His contract was set to be coming up with Becky's in June, so I do wonder if WWE would just add the time he misses to extend the contract, or if they'll work on a new deal while he's out. Speaking of deals and injuries, that brings us to Drew McIntyre. He is currently working with a badly hyperextended elbow that he injured at WrestleMania. This is according to PW Insider. He was wearing a sleeve on his arm during WWE's UK tour this week. Per Fightful, his contract is also said to be expiring in the next 5 to 6 weeks, and he still has not re-signed with the company. But he did share a photo on his social media of CM Punk with the WWE Championship at Money in the Bank 2011 blowing a kiss to Vince McMahon as he was leaving through the crowd, teasing the idea that he may pull a Punk and leave with the championship. To do that, though, he would have to first win the championship. And it just so happens that they have a PLE coming up in Scotland in June, right around the time that his deal is said to be up. So it's a little eerie how his contract status really mirrors that of Punk all those years ago. I don't think Punk actually signed the new deal with WWE until the day of Money in the Bank. I think it was when he got to the building in Chicago that day that he actually signed his contract. And they worked a storyline out of it, but then they brought him back way too soon. After he said, look, I'm going to go, I'm going to win the title, and then I'm going to leave. Maybe I'll take it to Ring of Honor, maybe I'll take it to New Japan Pro Wrestling. They could have really had some fun with that, and they didn't do it, because they had a SummerSlam match to promote. I would love to see them redo it and get it right this time with Drew, right? Not for too long, but just take a little more time with it, right? Because you got to have your champion around. You can't have Drew win the title and disappear for 3 months. But, you know, seeing Drew show up at these different independent shows or a TNA taping or, you know, something like that, All Japan, right? They sent Charlie Dempsey to All Japan. Maybe they could send him to Japan, send him there with the World Heavyweight title. That could be fun. I don't see McIntyre leaving the company. I mean, they keep saying he has not re-signed. He's still a free agent. Unless he wants to go and hit the indie scene with Jinder Mahal and reform 3MB, I don't see him going anywhere. On Raw Monday night, we had an Intercontinental title main event in Montreal. Sami Zayn in his hometown defending the championship against Chad Gable. Chad Gable did not win the Intercontinental title, but he did turn heel. He did snap when the match was over. Sami Zayn, literally in mid-embrace with his wife in the front row, and he gets scooped up and dropped, dumped right on the back of his neck with a German suplex on the floor. We had that parting shot of Chad Gable in the ropes. He had Sami Zayn in the ropes, trapped in an ankle lock as he looked down, screaming at him. His wife was right there in the front row. It was a great scene, exactly what Gable needed. He's still going to be in the hunt. He's still going to be in the Intercontinental title picture. On Twitter, Julius Creed of the Creed Brothers, he tweeted, ready, willing, and ... and he left it open-ended. And now there's talk that maybe the Creeds go heel and we get a new heel trio with Chad Gable and the Creeds, which would be like a new age version of Team Angle. Remember Kurt Angle and the world's greatest tag team, Shelton Benjamin and Charlie Haas? I would love it. I would love it. Actually, somebody wrote into me, and I'll get to it in the mailbag, with an interesting idea for that whole concept. But I love the idea of Chad Gable leading a new Team Angle-like faction with the Creed Brothers. I think that would be great. I love what they did, and the match itself was great. Sammy's entrance, one of the all-time great Raw entrances that has ever been done. It was just extended shot of him walking into the building from outside, being swarmed by fans on the concourse, and then going through the crowd, draped in the maple leaf. It was so great. Now, Bronson Reed, he confronted Chad Gable in the back right before Gable went out for the match and said, whether it's you or Sammy, he's next in line for a shot at the Intercontinental title. So I don't know if that means that Sammy is going to defend against Bronson Reed first at Backlash, and then they'll get back to the Gable stuff, or if they're going to turn this into a triple threat. All I know is this. The next time Chad Gable gets in that ring with Sami Zayn and the Intercontinental title is on the line, he has to win. And that really is the key to this heel turn here. If this is going to be the start of a heel turn, the start of a new attitude for Chad Gable, he's going to lead a new group, whatever it is, he cannot continue to lose. He has lost every single opportunity that he has had at this championship going back to Gunther. And the next time he gets in the ring with Sami, he has to win. That's it. And then Sammy could chase to get it back. But he's got to win. That is going to be the key to this working or not. It's going to be very hard to take this guy seriously if he gets one more shot, even after this, and he loses again. Now, Sheamus made his return on Raw Monday night. He was out for 8 months. He returned with a win over Ivar, and he returned with his old music. I mean, they kept the intro into his most recent theme, but then it transitions into the old theme. So, of course, all the memes came back. Too Many Limes, Lobster Head. I love that fucking song. Michael Cole mentioned that he underwent neck surgery. I thought it was a shoulder issue that he was out with. I didn't realize it was that serious. I don't think Sheamus has worked a match since Edge had his last match before leaving for AEW, because Edge wrestled Sheamus on SmackDown. I think that might have been both their final matches. And so Sheamus is back. It's great to see him back. And on Raw, where the Intercontinental title is, at least for now, he said on Instagram that 2 months ago, he thought he was retiring. That's how bad it was. He thought he was hanging up his tights. He was, you know, putting his boots away, and that was going to be it. But a lot of doctors and trainers and physios helped get him cleared. But he was also the butt of a lot of jokes because of his physique. He came back looking a lot softer than he used to be. I noticed it too. But the man is 46 years old, coming off of neck surgery. So it is completely understandable. But people mocked him for it. They created memes out of it. And he seemed to take it all in good fun. But I'm sure it must have bothered him. I mean, how could it not? How could it not bother him? Here's a guy who, you know, he's an athlete who obviously takes his physique seriously and you know, works out a lot. He wrestles in his fucking underwear on television every single week in front of millions of people. He's got his own workout channel on YouTube, so we know he takes fitness seriously. It can't feel good to see people posting too many pies on Twitter. Now, he shared some of the memes himself, and then he said this. He goes, okay, take your best shots, whale miss, too many pies, and then we're done with the photoshopping and the shaming. I was aiming for the draft. I got an early call-up. My bad. On me. I've been sleeping in the gym ever since, so watch this space. I appreciate the love. Hashtag Sheamus. Reminds me of when Steve Austin had spinal fusion surgery, and 3 months later, they rushed him out there to do a run-in on The Rock Triple H match of Backlash, one of the biggest sustained pops that you'll ever hear ever in the history of the business. And he came out there with a chair, and he was noticeably heavier. He took a lot of abuse for that. The guy was still in a neck halo until a few weeks before that appearance. Couldn't even move his neck. What do you think? He was back in the gym 2 weeks after fusion surgery? But that's where all the Fat Austin jokes came from. So give it a few weeks, and I'm sure this guy will be shredded again, and then that'll shut people up. And let's talk about the WWE draft. The draft commences on SmackDown this Friday. It continues into Raw next Monday. They have Lee Fitting leading production for them, and with his background at ESPN, what I'd like to see them do is make the draft more, I guess, draft-like would be the best way I could describe it. I think we need more trades with the GMs, even the night of. I mean, I'd like to see trades throughout the year here and there, but you could even do them the night of. You could have cutaways to the panel that we usually get on the kickoff shows at a desk in the back of the arena, evaluating the picks as the show goes on. I'm expecting more of a sports-like presentation for it. And I don't mean the war room that we had that first year. I think they went to Fox. Remember the war room, and who was it, Natalia or somebody got drafted, and everybody in the room was like jumping up and down, you know, like the U.S. had just attacked its like mortal enemy. We have struck North Korea, and everybody in the fucking war room is jumping up and down. I mean, give me a break. So I think there are ways to try to do it without going too over the top. So I'd like to see that. But as far as the moves, and I just jotted down a bunch of things here, kind of stream of consciousness. First of all, this should be obvious. You know, Roman Reigns should be a free agent, like Brock Lesnar was, assuming he's going to be off television for a while. Same with Seth Rollins. If they're going to miss, you know, months of time, there's no reason to draft them anywhere right now. So just keep them on the free agent list. The question is, who gets the first pick in the draft? Because whoever gets that first pick, why would they not want Cody Rhodes on their show? This entire WrestleMania was built around this guy. This guy is now the undisputed champion. SmackDown got the first pick in last year's draft because the draft started on SmackDown. Guess what? The draft starts on SmackDown again this year. So assuming SmackDown is getting that first pick, I think Cody Rhodes is staying there. He's going to be on the blue brand going forward. That's what I would do. And that way, Damian Priest keeps the World Heavyweight title on Raw. And Adam Pearce can draft the entire Judgment Day with his first pick, including the champion. You know, last year, factions were drafted together. So I'm just assuming it's going to work the same way this year. We don't know that because they haven't said. It's not like they've laid out the rules of the draft. Maybe they'll do that on Raw tomorrow night, but they have not told us anything as far as how the rules are going to work. The only thing we know is that NXT will also be involved. But if they swap the champions, then the other Raw champions have to be swapped too, because otherwise, what's the point of having all the belts, all the new belts looking the same if they're not going to be on the same show? You look at the Raw belts, right? The World Heavyweight title, the Women's World Heavyweight title, and the new Raw Tag Team titles. There's a uniformity to all of them. They all look the same. Makes no sense to put the Women's World title on SmackDown and move the other one to Raw. It would be stupid. Unless you draft all the champions together. Now, there is an argument to be made for swapping the champions. And with Damian Priest on SmackDown, also then drafting Jey Uso back to SmackDown. That way, the match of Backlash would still make sense because you'd have two SmackDown guys. But now, you know, as this new Bloodline story unfolds, you've got Jey back on the blue brand if you do that. Especially if they were to cost him the World Heavyweight title at Backlash. I wouldn't do it, though. I don't think he needs to be on SmackDown right now. And when the time comes, if they need him on SmackDown for the Bloodline story to progress and to do an Usos reunion or to have a Roman Reigns and Usos reunion, that's where the concept of trades comes in. See, I like the idea of the GMs utilizing brand trades more often throughout the year instead of people just randomly showing up on whatever show they want, whenever they want. So Jey Uso can stay right where he is, and when the story calls for it, if you want him on SmackDown, there are ways to get him on SmackDown. So I would keep the Judgment Day together on Raw. That includes Rhea Ripley. When she returns, she can go after Liv Morgan. I think the WrestleMania match next year should be Rhea Ripley against Bianca Belair for the Women's World title. Bianca has her team with Jade Cargill right now. They're probably going to win the tag team title soon on SmackDown. I would keep her right where she is. She could win the Women's Royal Rumble next year, and she could choose to face Rhea, who will be champion again before then, and that's how you do that match. So the key champions should stay right where they are. I think the top champions anyway should have draft protection. I would consider swapping Sami Zayn and Logan Paul and moving the U.S. and the Intercontinental titles, but I really think Sheamus needs to be on whatever show the Intercontinental title is going to be on, and they just brought him back to Raw. You know, people like him and Bron Breakker and Jade Cargill, who were, you know, signed by the GMs of one show or the other. Like, it would be dumb for them to not have draft protection and stay where they are. Why would they make such a big deal about Nick Aldis signing Bron Breakker into a contract signing a few weeks ago, and then he gets drafted to Raw? So they should stay where they are. Sheamus should stay where he is. And I would probably keep those titles right where they are. I've gone back and forth on this. Ultimately, though, I think I would keep all the main roster champions exactly where they are. LA Knight can stay on SmackDown and feud with Logan Paul. Chad Gable and the Creeds, get them together as a heel trio. Let Gable win the Intercontinental title from Sami Zayn. I would also keep Randy Orton on SmackDown, and I would have him as Cody's next challenger for the WWE title after the program with AJ Styles runs its course. Because I'm guessing that they're going to get more than one match out of that. And then at that point, Randy could be up next. Because there's a ton of history there between Cody and Randy. I mean, you could have them feuding for months. I would draft Charlotte Flair from SmackDown to the Raw Women's Division. They could use her more than SmackDown can. I don't think Charlotte and Tiffany Stratton need to be on the same brand right now. I would also move Naomi to Raw. I think that's where Jimmy Uso ends up anyway. And how about this? I would consider drafting Becky Lynch from Raw to SmackDown. And Seth Rollins could land there too when he's ready to come back. She's already worked. I mean, think about the women that Becky has already worked with just in the last several months. I'm not talking all time because Becky has worked with almost everybody anyway. But just in the last few months, she's worked with Rhea. She's worked with Nia. She's worked with Liv. And this is all recent. And we know her history with Charlotte. I don't think we need them on the same brand. I think she would benefit from a change in scenery. And I don't know when she's going to be back on TV. She may pop up in the Battle Royal on Raw tomorrow night, wrestling for the World Heavyweight title. Her contract is also up in the next few weeks. But I would seriously consider moving her to SmackDown. I think Alexa Bliss could be back on TV very soon as this week. And I would have her on Raw. Carmella is another name who recently gave birth and has been out for many months. I know she was still having health issues, something with her foot, some kind of nerve issue with her foot. That was months ago. I mean, I don't follow along with her stories or anything. I don't know if there's been any update on that since then or how she's doing. But with Corey Graves as the lead announcer on SmackDown, I think SmackDown would be the more likely landing spot for her. So I say Bliss to Raw and Carmella as a surprise in the draft to SmackDown. And so that adds some more names that have been out for a while to each women's division. Gunther. I would keep Gunther where he is. I would keep Gunther and Imperium on Raw, have him go after the World Heavyweight Championship this summer. Braun Strowman has been out for about a year now, almost a year, after spinal fusion surgery. I don't think he's been medically cleared yet, but he's getting close. I would draft him over to SmackDown. I think he could be a good heel challenger at some point this year for Cody to overcome. Then we have NXT. The NXT champion right now is Ilya Dragunov. He had a match on Raw with Nakamura a few weeks ago. So did Roxanne Perez, the NXT women's champion. I think Dragunov is going to be drafted to Raw. I want him on the same brand with Gunther. That's what I would do. I would draft him over to Raw. Roxanne Perez, I would keep her in NXT. I think it would be a mistake to draft both champions at the same time. I mean, you already have the NXT champion you're going to call up. Roxanne just won back the NXT women's title. I don't think you need to call her up and Ilya in the same draft. So I would keep her where she is. But I think Carmelo Hayes is definitely coming up, and I would put him on SmackDown. I would have Carmelo Hayes on SmackDown as a heel. And I look at that women's division in NXT, and I could see somebody like a Lyra Valkyria being called up. I like Fallon Henley. I like Fallon Henley. I would send her from NXT to Raw. Put her in that Raw women's division. I have not been following NXT as much over the past couple of months. I really need to get caught up on everything, but I always liked her. I think she may be going heel. I think they're doing an angle right now where she may be going heel soon. But I think the Raw division needs at least one fresh name, and she would be my pick for that spot from NXT. And then lastly, if I look at the main roster right now, there's a few different names that I think you could always send to NXT for a while. I would send Shinsuke Nakamura back to NXT. When Nakamura first debuted, it was in NXT. He was a massive deal. Not so much now. I mean, we're talking, oh my God, I mean, when he debuted at that Dallas NXT TakeOver show, it was 2016. And here we are now, 8 years later. He has been beaten and beaten and beaten by everybody on that Raw roster. And if he goes to SmackDown, it'll be the exact same thing. I think he would benefit from taking a little respite from the main roster, as Baron Corbin has benefited. And I would send Nakamura to NXT for a while. Doesn't have to be a year or anything like that, but I think him spending at least a few months down there, I think could be good for the people he works with in NXT, but it could also help rejuvenate him a little bit. You know, if he stays on Raw, if he stays on SmackDown, he's jobber bait. That's all he's going to be. You know, in NXT, I guarantee you this, in NXT, they would have him, Shawn Michaels would have him doing more than he would be doing on either one of these two shows. And then when you need him, eventually you can bring him back up. But those are my draft thoughts. Let me know yours. And then we can talk about them this week. I'll be live after SmackDown on YouTube Friday night to go after all the Night 1 picks, because we got Night 1 coming up on Friday. Rossi Ogawa, the founder and former booker for Stardom, the biggest Joshi promotion in Japan, and probably the biggest women's promotion anywhere in the world, was fired from Stardom in February after being accused of trying to poach talent on his way out. He was planning to leave anyway. He was not happy about not having full power and having some of his decisions overruled. Again, it was his company at one time, but it had been sold to Bushiroad a number of years ago. They kept him on. But I guess he wasn't happy with some of the decisions that were being made. So the plan was for him to exit gracefully, but then they fired him instead. Now, he denied the poaching allegations and said that he would be starting a new promotion. And this week, that promotion was officially launched. It is called Dream Star Fighting Marigold, or Marigold for short. They held a press conference on Monday to make the announcement, and they also have a working agreement in place with WWE. WWE flew Ogawa and Julia, one of the biggest names to come out of Stardom, to Philadelphia for WrestleMania weekend. They were both shown on camera with William Regal in the crowd at NXT Stand and Deliver, and Julia was backstage at WrestleMania as well. She left Stardom for two reasons, because she's on her way to WWE, but also to help Rossi start his new promotion. Julia is the biggest name on the roster. The expectation is that she will be working for both companies for a little while before eventually moving to the U.S. And at that point, she will be full-time with probably NXT to start. Corey Brennan for Fightful Select is reporting that the belief within NXT is that Julia will have her debut match at the NXT Heatwave show on July 7th, and that she is expected to be challenging for one of the NXT women's titles on that show. NXT is introducing a new Women's North American Championship, so it would be that or the main NXT women's title. So she'll work for both for a while, and then after a few months, she'll be exclusive to WWE. She might make an appearance here and there for Marigold, you know, should they want her. Now, Ogawa was in Philadelphia also trying to work out a deal to get Io Sky and Kairi Sane to come to Marigold for a major show this summer. Marigold's first show will be held May 20th at Corican Hall, which sold out instantly, with Julia and a mystery partner taking on Saray and a mystery partner. And just as word of this working agreement with WWE and Marigold started making the rounds this week, and they had their big press conference on Monday, Kenny Omega went and dropped a nuclear bomb on things with comments that he made during one of his Twitch streams, because Kenny is he's still convalescing from his bout with diverticulitis. He's probably still going to have surgery, intestinal surgery very soon. So who knows when he's going to be back. So in his time off, he has set up a room, I guess, you know, in his home or his apartment, whatever, where he's gaming and he's streaming on Twitch and people can ask questions. And so these Twitch streams have made quite the headlines in recent weeks. First for his comments about CM Punk and Brawl Out, and now for his comments about Rossi Ogawa. He was asked about Ogawa, and his comments raised a lot of eyebrows. He said, "I would say don't be so quick to listen to praise for that individual, because someday, I'm not sure when it will be, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but someday, people will know the truth. What they do with that truth, I don't know. Will they share it? Maybe. A lot of the higher-ups in Japan, they know exactly what business he's up to, and what he's been up to for decades, that's all I gotta say." And that was, in fact, not all that he had to say. When he was asked about Rossi being an e-drone, since Marigold has a partnership with WWE, Omega said that he didn't care about that, as it's not even the tip of the iceberg. He said there are a lot of people that refuse to work for him for the very same reason who are currently in WWE and in AEW. He said, if you want to know along what lines they tread amongst, the dude just flat out said, hey, we're looking for girls ages 13 to 21 that don't have a boyfriend and aren't married. We already know he puts underage girls in very revealing swimsuit calendars and books. I wish that's all he did. Let's put it that way. I don't have any sort of video evidence. I just have the good word of people that are very close. I'm outside of it. If those people feel like commenting or saying something, whatever. For now, I'll just say that people going to Marigold, good luck. I hope you have a great time. I hope it works out for you. For me, I would be very hesitant. That's it. And then he said, you know, redact my comments. And he said, I didn't say anything. Before again questioning the desired age range for Marigold's talent or trainees. And then he agreed with one commenter who said that he should delete the video. He said he was not going on record with anything because he didn't want any lawyers barking at his door. I think it may be too late for that. And he finished by saying that he supports Asuka and that she's got her reasons, probably the same one as mine. Now, if you remember, Asuka went on a diatribe on social media last summer. I covered it on the podcast. She was shooting on Stardom and how the promotion was created just to destroy her personally. Although she never mentioned Rossi Ogawa by name. There's a reason why they are working on a deal to bring Io and Kairi into Marigold and not Asuka. But, you know, wow. There's a lot to digest here. First of all, I hate when people say something without actually saying. But in this case, I understand Kenny not wanting to get himself into any kind of legal trouble. You know, it's kind of like his way of warning people and stepping right up to the line without going over it. For Kenny Omega, of all people, that's the other thing that struck me about these comments. Kenny Omega, he's always complimentary of everyone, you know, and he's a very laid-back guy. I don't know if I've ever seen him get angry before, even on TV, let alone in like an interview or anything. Even CM Punk last week in the aftermath of all the stuff that went down there, right? He was pretty complimentary of Punk. Even Jim Cornette, who hates this man's guts. I don't think I have ever heard Kenny Omega say anything or insinuate anything as bad about Cornette as what he did here about Rossi Ogawa in that video. And again, think of all the horrible shit that Cornette has said about this man. If Kenny Omega was burning on the side of the road, Cornette would not piss on him to put it out. And I still have never heard Kenny Omega say anything as, or insinuate anything as awful about him as he did here in this video. But he didn't mince any words. You know, he said basically this man is a creep and there's some really fucked up things going on that he has heard about. And that's the key. He stressed that he has not personally witnessed any of this himself. He has not experienced any of this himself. It's only things that he has heard secondhand from people that have worked there or have been around Rossi and know him well. And Kenny Omega is pretty plugged into the Joshi scene. People make fun of him for it. You know, he brought Riho into AEW and brought Riho into his home. And some of these Twitch streams, I saw Riho on there. I don't know what that means. But so he's somebody who's pretty plugged into that scene and has tried to recruit people to come over and bring them to AEW from the Joshi scene. It's very telling to me that it's Kenny saying this and being so blunt. And it might give WWE pause before they decide to enter into a working relationship with this man, you know, being that their own company still has a sex trafficking lawsuit pending against it. I'm starting to understand all of those happy tweets from Tony Khan after Rossi got fired. But what Kenny is referring to about Marigold looking for younger, unmarried women. The promotion said they're looking for new wrestlers to train, and they want them to be between the ages, I think it was 13 and 30. He said 13 and 21. I think it's 13 and 30, but they want them unmarried. Now, John Pollock had an interview with Karen Peterson, who works for the website Post Wrestling. I wanted to give her a shout out here because I thought it was a good interview, and then I noticed that she blocked me on Twitter. I've never interacted with this woman once in my entire life, but evidently I got all up in her feelings But she was talking about how it's more of a cultural thing in Japan, where these promotions, and not just Stardom, they have Ice Ribbon. I mean, there's more than one Joshi promotion. But they want girls that are younger, who can make the commitment to train. So they go to school, they train, they wrestle. Or they work part-time, and they train, and they wrestle. And that's it. That's their lives. But also, she pointed out that the fan base for these Joshi promotions is predominantly male. Men in their 30s. Now, that doesn't make it any less creepy when we're talking about underage girls. In fact, that makes it worse. You know, they do these photo shoots of these girls, some of them underage and like bathing suits and stuff. It's like a Victoria's Secret catalog. But Japan also, just last year, they lowered their age of adulthood from 20 to 18. It's the first time in 140 years they changed the legal definition of an adult in Japan. When Rossi sold Stardom to Bushiroad in 2019, Bushiroad changed things where they didn't want anybody under the age of 18. Apparently, Rossi wants to keep things old school. And when you hear the Kenny Omega comments, vague as they are, you read between the lines and it just makes it that much creepier. This week's episode is sponsored by Factor. You know, the weather is starting to get real nice, starting to warm up. That means summer is right around the corner. I want to make sure I'm eating right, but I don't want to do it and not enjoy the food that I'm eating. With Factor meals, I don't need to stress because I know that every meal is ready to eat and never frozen. They're chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in 2 minutes flat. The last thing I want to do when I'm hungry is have to wait. Then I get hangry. You don't want to see me when I'm hangry. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Plus more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. Why wouldn't you want a chef-prepared meal on the table in 2 minutes? It's like having your own personal chef in your kitchen. That's what you get with Factor's ready-to-eat meals. If you're looking for gourmet options, try meals with premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up, so it's no fuss and no mess. They're also tailored to your schedule. You can customize weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. You can pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. And they're celebrating Earth Day all month long. So be on the lookout for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for Factor's lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/solomonster50 and use the code solomonster50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code solomonster50 at factormeals.com/solomonster50. To get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. This week's Dark Side of the Ring tackled the story of Chris Adams, the gentleman and the demon. Almost like the tale of two people. You had some people saying he was a great guy, other people saying that he was a terrible human being. 1 minute he could be charming, the next he could be a monster. He puts the dark in Dark Side of the Ring for sure. His daughter said that he didn't want his demons, but they got him anyway, and that he was a great person who's not here to defend himself, and so she wants to do that for him because she loved her father. Which is understandable. That doesn't necessarily make him a great person, though. He was a 20-year veteran, won 26 championships throughout his career, but may be best known for being the man who trained a young Steve Austin, who did not think very highly of him. In his book, he called Adams a pile of crap, and he once said after Adams died, "I didn't comment when Chris died and the Dallas Morning News called me. I wasn't going to run him down in the paper because the guy was dead, but I didn't think a whole lot of him." Now, it's funny that Chris Adams trained Steve Austin when Adams himself never had any formal pro wrestling training. He relied on his background in judo. I know his brother was a judo champion, I think a silver medalist. And so when he broke into the wrestling business, that's really what he relied on. He is credited with inventing the super kick, which is really just a judo thrust kick, but he threw in the leg slap so that it would make a sound, which everybody does now to the point where it doesn't mean anything. But he used it as his signature move. He was the guy who used the super kick. And they interviewed Kevin Von Erich. Iceman King Parsons and David Manning for this, all of whom worked with Chris in World Class Championship Wrestling, which is where he won the majority of the titles in his career. Beyond his son and his daughter, they also got his brother for this episode, Neil, and his ex-girlfriend, Jeannie Clark, who played Lady Blossom when she managed Steve Austin in WCW. The two of them were also married for a while, Austin and Jeannie, and she was the one who told Austin one day after the office had given him all those terrible names to choose from. Right? Fang McFrost, and Ice Dagger, and he's sitting at home one day thinking, man, you know, because he doesn't want to be the ringmaster anymore. So he's trying to come up with names, and it was Jeannie who said to him famously, drink your tea before it gets stone cold. And that's where stone cold came from. Adams met her at a bar. He hit on her at a bar when she was 19, and she thought that he looked like Paul McCartney. And within a month, they were living together, and he had the idea to make her his valet on TV. And they had a daughter together, but the relationship fell apart after he cheated on her. So they were still cordial. She just didn't want to have a romantic relationship with him anymore, but she was still active, you know, with him on TV. They said Chris had a reputation for being very Jekyll and Hyde. Kind of like the angel and the devil. He could switch between the two very quickly, especially once he got some alcohol in him. Kevin Von Erich said that a lot of wrestlers used to be bullies. And case in point, one day their driver made them late for a show. So Chris did a very rational thing. He reached over into the driver's seat and began choking the man, nearly to death. And there are plenty of stories like this. And then there's this, a little more lighthearted, but just as crazy. Bruce Pritchard told this story on his podcast years ago. It was the first time he ever met Chris Adams. Chris was fresh out of jail, he said, which was a common occurrence. And the two of them were out one night. They were looking for a place to drink. They were in Little Rock, Arkansas, which at the time was a dry town. So it was no easy feat to find a place to drink. So they were having a problem getting into a club, and they got recognized by two couples who got them in. And so they're drinking and they're partying, and they end up going back to one of the couples had a double-wide trailer. So they all go back to the trailer. And then out comes the drugs. After a while, Bruce noticed that Chris was missing and one of the wives was missing. And he goes and he finds them in one of the back rooms having sex. The husband went to go find his wife, and when he did, he must have thought that she left or something. When he did, the two of them, Bruce and Chris, they got the hell out of there. He said that was the first time and the last time that he ever hung out with Chris Adams. But that story is downright tame compared to some of these other ones. In World Class, Adams got paired up with Gino Hernandez. They did an angle where, you know, Adams had been a babyface, kind of like the kind English gentleman, very over with the women there. As the Von Erichs were, they did an angle where he turned on Kevin Von Erich, and then he and Gino became a heel tag team, and they found a lot of success. And then Gino was found dead at the age of 28 of a cocaine overdose, although not everybody believes that story. Remember, Gino got his own Dark Side episode one of the previous seasons. I covered it at the time. There were a lot of, you know, people thinking, well, it was, you know, he was a victim of a hit, and there's all kinds of crazy conspiracies about what happened to Gino Hernandez. But after Gino died, Chris's alcohol and his drug problems, they spiraled even more out of control. I mean, they were bad enough. They got even worse. And they told a very short version of what has been dubbed the Israel incident. This was actually covered in the Tales from the Territories episode on World Class. World Class, for whatever reason, was very popular on TV in Israel. They loved the Von Erichs. And on one trip over there, Chris Adams beat up a bartender, they claimed, by super kicking him and knocking the man's eye out. Yes, another eyeball story. You know, even if one of these stories was ever proven to be true, there's no way that they all are, so I just assume that they're all full of shit. This man gouged a guy's eye out with his bare hands. Then this guy super kicked someone's eyeball out of their skull. Brutus Beefcake was walking down the hallway in the hospital with Hulk Hogan when he blinked and his fucking eye fell out of his head. Like, imagine this man super kicking someone so hard that their eye falls out. That would be the greatest finish of all time. Except today, the other guy would kick out at two. And then he would lose to a roll-up or something. Anyway. So now they have to get him the hell out of the country before the cops pick him up. So David Manning rushes him to the airport in a disguise. And he makes it onto the plane. Manning gets back to his hotel, and the cops are there waiting for him to ask him about Chris Adams. But he just played dumb and said, oh, I have no idea where he is. Now, from the Israeli incident, there was the plane ride from hell. Not the WWE plane ride from hell. This predated that one. He had a return flight from Puerto Rico. It got grounded for hours. There was some kind of mechanical issue. So to keep the passengers happy, the airline offered them an open bar, which Chris Adams was more than happy to partake in. Once they were up in the air, they cut him off. They said no more alcohol. And that's where things went south. He unloaded on the flight attendant, called her a bitch, among other things that I won't repeat. That brought out the co-pilot from the cockpit to try to calm him down. And he ended up grabbing the pilot by his collar and headbutting him three times before he was finally subdued. Now, I found some old UPI wire stories about the case, and he could have been charged with a felony. That would have carried up to 20 years in prison. Instead, he was convicted of a misdemeanor assault, and he faced up to 6 months in jail. He wound up serving half that. He served 90 days behind bars. Then there was another story. They didn't tell it here, but there was another story where they were in the Middle East somewhere and he broke a hotel clerk's orbital bone by stomping on his face over not being able to use the phone. And I don't know if he was drunk or not. That may have just been him getting angry. But again, I understand sticking up for your dad because he's your dad and you think he's a great guy. But there are just too many stories like this that say otherwise as far as what kind of person this guy was. After the plane incident and his time behind bars, he gets talked into starting his own wrestling school. For a guy, again, who had no formal wrestling training himself, it's kind of funny how now he's going to start his own wrestling school. And his first student, who saw the infomercials that he was cutting on TV advertising it was Steve Austin, or Steve Williams. He would become Steve Austin. And we got some early Austin footage. They ended up working a feud together in Dallas that got pretty heated. As far as, you know, Jeannie being involved, and I think Chris's his new wife or girlfriend, she was involved too, so they would have cat fights. So it got a lot of heat. And they started, by starting that angle together, it led to Austin and Jeannie getting together off camera in real life. The daughter in the episode thought that it was wild to think that her mom, her dad, her stepdad, and her stepmom all worked a program together. And when she said that, I realized I guess that would make Steve Austin her stepdad. But after a while, Austin felt like he was being held back. Adams felt like, hey, this kid's about to outshine me and become bigger than me, which he eventually did. And that apparently ate him up inside, that he wound up being remembered more for training Steve Austin than for his own wrestling career. But there was another incident where Adams was in the back seat with his young son. His wife was at the wheel. They got into an argument. And it nearly caused an accident with an 18-wheeler. Chris beat this woman so badly that she needed to have surgery on her face. Now, the son in the episode says that he was a little bit older when his mom showed him the photos of what he had done to her. And he was stunned that his father would be capable of that. But that was enough for her to finally leave him. Chris eventually got a shot with WCW in 1997. This was when they were the number one wrestling company in the world. But they just used him as an enhancement talent. I don't know why he would have thought they would have used him any other way. I mean, he had no chance of being pushed at a serious level. I mean, I think he would have fit right in with Lord Steven Regal and Dave Taylor, but they apparently didn't want to work with him. Or at least Regal didn't. There was some kind of heat there. Regal didn't want to work with him. He actually wrestled Macho Man. A little interesting trivia note. Chris Adams wrestled Macho Man Randy Savage in the very first match on the very first episode of WCW Thunder. That might be his big claim to fame during that period of time in WCW. But there were stories of him promoting events and then bailing with the money and not paying people. Jim Ross once called him a con man and said that he abused women, had a bad temper, and he was generally not a very good person. Chris got heavily into the drug GHB, and that ended up leading to tragedy. Chris was staying with a man named Bure at the time, who was interviewed for the episode. I swear to God, go take a look at this guy and tell me he does not look like George Mizanin. I swear, I was like, the Miz's dad killed Chris Adams? My mind is blown. But I swear to you, go take a look at this guy and his hair and everything in the episode and tell me he does not bear a resemblance to George Mizanin. So Chris needed a place to stay. He had no money at the time. And so he stayed with Bure, whose real name is Brent. And he got along with Chris. He considered him a friend. They actually became very good friends. He allowed him to live in his home. He was also Chris's driver, so Chris could get around while he was all messed up, and so he wouldn't be a danger on the road to other people. He used this man. I mean, that's basically what it was. You know, Chris very clearly used this man. Probably saw him as an easy mark, took advantage of the man's generosity. Then he ends up falling in love with a woman named Linda, and they were only dating for a few weeks. He brings Linda home one night, and so Bure heads to bed. He didn't want to have anything to do with whatever they were going to be doing. But he says in the episode he had warned Chris before, I don't want that GHB stuff in this house. Anything else you want to do, I don't care. It's your business, but no GHB. So Bure goes to bed. This was maybe 2:30 in the morning. A few hours later, it's 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning. Bure gets up. He said, well, it must have been how eerily quiet it was that woke him up, I guess. But he gets up, he walks in, and he finds them both passed out. Chris was slumped over a chair. Linda is on the floor on her back. The way he described it is her lungs started wheezing. So what does Bure do? Does Bure call 911? Nope. Bure calls their friend to ask what he should do, because he's afraid that if he calls the cops, Chris is going to be pissed. And the friend at least had enough common sense to say, they're not breathing. Call the fucking cops. Now, Linda ended up dying from an overdose of alcohol and GHB. And Chris would, you know, talk about it and say, oh, it's such an unfortunate thing, and it was just a total accident. And then, yeah, there are other people who say that it was him, you know, that he's the one to blame, and, you know, he probably gave it to her. And again, we'll never know for sure. Obviously, both were complicit if they were both doing things they shouldn't have been doing. I'm sure he was not a great influence on her. Let's just put it that way. Now, the following year, Adams was indicted on a manslaughter charge and was for her death, and was still awaiting trial at the time of his own death, which came in October of 2001. Bure had been the best man at Chris's wedding. This was only a month before this happened. Right? Like I said, they were very good friends. Chris and Bure one night are hanging out at Bure's mother's house, and they're drinking. And he doesn't know what set Chris off, but he got real angry all of a sudden. The demon came out. He may have asked him, keep it down, my mom is trying to sleep, whatever it was. He just flew into a rage. Now, Bure said he had a 4-post bed. Chris broke one of the posts off and swung at him with it. Then he put Bure in a sleeper hold, pushed him onto the bed. He started gouging his eyes. He bit Bure on the face and the neck. And now he starts choking him. And Bure thought he was going to die. So he reaches over. He kept a .38 caliber handgun on his end table. Reaches over, grabs the gun. He puts the gun to Chris's shoulder, and he pulls the trigger. And when he did, I guess the way Chris moved, this is according to Bure now, the way he moved or whatever, he ended up shooting him in the heart, and he killed him. Now, they showed some of the crime scene photos of the gun on the end table, and they even had a shot of Chris, his body, just, you know, he was laying there dead in bed. You can't see his face. He's laying ass up, but there he is. And they said the funeral for him was packed. Bure was eventually found to have acted in self-defense, so he wasn't charged with anything. He's a free man today. And even though, look, we weren't there, so we can never know for sure how this all played out. You know, two guys getting drunk, they're roughhousing, right? Who knows what led to what? But it sounds very plausible, given Chris's past behavior, especially when he was drinking, all the stories of how he would just fly into a rage, his eyes would glow, and he would attack people. I can believe this man feared for his life and acted in self-defense. And it sounds very appropriate that alcohol, ultimately, is what did in Chris Adams. David Manning says he'll remember Chris for being great in the ring, but he was also a man that did not want to control his alcoholism. His daughter wishes that he was here to see how his kids turned out, and she thinks that he would be proud of them. It's always the kids that end up being hurt in these stories. So, I mean, just episode after episode over these last however many seasons now it's been, five seasons, I guess, of Dark Side of the Ring, so many stories like this. Too many stories of drinking and men making orphans out of their kids and widows out of their wives. It's pathetic. When you live hard, you die hard. And they don't have to suffer the consequences for it because they're dead. They don't care. It's their families. They're the ones who pay for it. But that's the story of Chris Adams. When you live hard, you die hard. This week's episode coming up is on Sherry Martel, which I am very much looking forward to. Let's get into some mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Kevin from Sycamore, Illinois. I had to include this. He says, my Dark Side of the Ring review last week on the Chris Colt story, where I talked about his partner trying to run him over with their car, was immediately followed by an ad for Discount Tires. Fucking great is that? How great is that? See? Just goes hand in hand. You hear that, all you sponsors out there? Nicole from Staten Island. This Monday is going to be 5 years since the very first episode of the Firefly Funhouse. Is it possible that Uncle Howdy may return on Raw? And if so, will he show up with a whole new family that includes Eric Rowan and Alexa Bliss? Well, Raw also happens to be in Columbus, Ohio tomorrow night, which is the hometown of Alexa Bliss. So I would say there's a pretty good chance that something is going to go down there. I don't know about the whole family, if there's going to be a whole big faction. I don't necessarily see them all being unveiled at once. It still feels a little early to me to debut an entire new family. We're only a few weeks into these glitches that we've been seeing. But a group led by Uncle Howdy, with Alexa and Eric Rowan and maybe even Braun Strowman, is something that I could see. James, also from Staten Island. Everyone is looking to SummerSlam for possible matches like Punk versus McIntyre and Cody versus Rock. I have another idea in mind, and that is Chad Gable versus Sami Zayn for the Intercontinental title. This coming Monday, Gable is suspended indefinitely for his actions after what happened last week. But over the next few weeks, you see vignettes of Gable training, and in the background, you hear a whistle going off, like it's his coach. But after the third week, the coach hands him a mouth guard and he puts it on, and the coach is revealed to be Kurt Angle. Upon his return, Sammy immediately challenges Gable to a match, but he turns it down, saying that he hasn't earned it. This would be on the advice of Coach Angle, telling him to let Sammy stew in his anger and then take the title from him after that. The next few months that go by is Gable racking up victories via submission in various ways, and whenever he fails, Angle makes him do difficult training drills. Eventually, the Creed brothers, who have been on a losing streak, seek the advice of Angle, who is willing to take them under his wing, and with three protégés, the Academy is born. At SummerSlam, not only do the Creed brothers capture the World Tag Team titles, but Chad Gable wins the Intercontinental title from Sami Zayn via submission. You now have a new heel faction on Raw, led by a legend that gives them instant credibility. What do you think? I think that's a hell of an idea that you've laid out there. I don't know that they can hold off until SummerSlam, though, to do the title change. I mean, I see what you're saying about, and Gable really should rack up some wins because he's been a fucking loser the last several months. I don't know that they're going to wait that long, though. I mean, SummerSlam is still a ways off. So to wait until then to do the match, that seems very unlikely to me. But the idea of bringing Kurt Angle in to be their coach or their manager, I don't know if it's something that Kurt would want to do. I think he might. I think he might be intrigued by that idea. I had somebody else write in to me and suggest the possibility that Gable Steveson could be part of this in some way. I'm not sold on that. I'd rather see Kurt Angle in there than Gable Steveson. But it's not a bad idea. Now, I like the whole idea of him presenting Gable with the mouth guard. Hopefully not his own mouth guard. You know, the one that Kurt wore. That would be disgusting. But presenting him with a mouth guard, and then we get that sort of wrestling machine version of Gable. Look, I always said it was such a fucking miss when they did the Kurt Angle son storyline, which was stupid to begin with. Like, Chad Gable was so obvious, it was the obvious choice, and they went with Jason Jordan just to shock people. Chad Gable is a hell of a lot more like Kurt Angle's son than Jason Jordan is. I mean, he just looks like him. I mean, come on. It's just natural. So to see the two of them together, I'd buy into that idea. I think that could work. But the whole idea of Gable and the Creeds being together in a heel trio, Creeds win the World Tag Team titles, Gable wins the IC title, I'm down for that. Lance from Houston. How would you feel about the following direction for Liv Morgan and Rhea Ripley? On Monday, Liv cuts a promo where she insists her incomplete revenge on Rhea is justified and even calls out fans for taking a liking to Rhea after what Rhea did to her. Liv's revenge is complete when she becomes the next Raw Women's Champion by winning with the Riptide. Over the next couple of months, she totally forgets about Rhea's warning due to the high of being champion. When people ask her about it, she's just, yeah, 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 and waves it off. Totally delusional because she is the champion. Rhea comes back as the babyface and chases, which culminates in a steel cage match. What do you think of this idea? You had me there until you mentioned the Riptide and Liv winning with Riptide. I feel like that would be ridiculous given how tiny she is. Unless she hits it on someone her size, then I guess it's not as ridiculous. But you take that part of it out, and I think that something like that works. Maybe she wins with the prism lock. Right, Rhea has that as a move also. Maybe she does that. But the rest that you've laid out here, I think, is quite plausible. I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, that Liv would kind of get a big head, and she's got what she wants now. She's the champion. She's completely deluded. And then Rhea shows up one day and gets her revenge. I think that's the story. That's the story that you tell. You know, you can change the little details around if you want to, but that's the story that I proposed. Sam. In Lancashire, UK, here's my idea to set up the return of Rhea Ripley, as I think the crowd clearly wants to cheer for her, but don't want to cheer for Dirty Dom. On Raw, I would have Liv Morgan capture the title, winning the Battle Royal. During the draft, I would have the Judgment Day as individual picks. Finn and Priest end up on one show together, being that they can do the split at some point and work a program for the world title. Dominic and JD go to the other to work as a tag team. Liv and Rhea also get drafted to the same show. While Rhea is away, Liv approaches Dom in a flirtatious manner and lets him know that clearly mommy is not always on top, but you do only live once. Also stealing her man, as well as her title and months of her career, setting up mommy's revenge tour. What say you? Again, I don't hate the idea. It's an interesting concept. I don't like the idea if it works. I don't like the idea of Dominic being with Liv. I don't think I would do that. But having her try to take everything away from Rhea is a good idea. You know, it's something that if this woman is obsessed with getting revenge, that would make sense for her to do. I took your career away. I took your title away. And now I'm going to take your boy. I'm going to take your man away from you. But, I mean, if that's going to result in Dominic going with her, I wouldn't do. And Clark from Medicine Hat, Alberta, Canada. Something fans like to discuss is what if Owen Hart did become WWF champion had he not passed away in that stunt? In my opinion, I think if he did win the world title, his run would have been like Chris Benoit's. He would have had his one run as world champion, and that would have been it, and he would have gone back to being a mid-carder. How do you think Owen Hart would have turned out as a WWF champion? I think he would have turned out exactly the way that you just said. And I think there was a time to do it in 94, and then Brett would win the belt back, and that would have been it. Because Owen was never going to be the WWF champion. You know, had he lived, had he continued to wrestle for them, he was not going to be the world champion. They had a chance to do it in 94. They didn't want to flip the title back and forth. They gave Owen King of the Ring instead. But there was an opportunity there in between King of the Ring and SummerSlam to pull off a shock title change, have Brett win the belt back in the cage match. They didn't do it. In 98, or the end of 97, when Owen came back after Montreal. He was gone for a while, signed a new deal with the company. I think he signed a new deal because Vince wouldn't let him go. So he comes back, and then instead of doing a title match with him and Shawn Michaels at the Royal Rumble, and that could have easily been a title match for the Royal Rumble. Not for WrestleMania, but for the Royal Rumble. They didn't even do it at the Rumble. They did it on Raw. They went with that idea and just putting Michaels and Undertaker together for a third match. They had already wrestled twice on pay-per-view. Instead of going with the fresh match, they said, oh, we'll do a third Undertaker-Shawn Michaels match. So we could do the casket spot with Kane, where he lights the casket on fire. So even then, when you saw Owen in a position where, okay, maybe this guy could be challenging for the world title, they couldn't even bring themselves to give him a match on pay-per-view for the belt. They never viewed him in that way. And I didn't either for the majority of his run. So if it didn't happen in 94, it was never going to happen. But let's say it did. Let's say it did. Let's say he won the title. He was never going to be at the level of a Rock or an Austin, you know, a multi-time champion, Triple H or somebody like that. It just wasn't going to happen. And I loved Owen Hart. I think Owen was great, but I just don't think he ever would have been at that level. So I think it would have played out exactly the way that you said. Keep emailing me. We'll do more next week. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. I'm going to be live tonight. You're getting a second show out of me because when Dynasty is over, I'll be live on YouTube to recap the entire show. So be sure to subscribe on the YouTube channel as we climb towards 80,000. Follow me on X as well, @Solomonster. I'll be tweeting tonight, talking about the pay-per-view, which don't forget, Dynasty this time in the U.S. is going to be available on multiple platforms. So it won't just be Bleacher Report. You know how I feel about that. You can get it on Fight or Triller TV, as it's called now. You can get it on YouTube. Still got to pay $50 for it, but you have multiple ways you can get the show. For those of you who have had issues, as I have, with Bleacher Report in the past, that's good news. I still haven't figured out if I should get it on Fight or get it on YouTube. I'll have to figure that out. But then I'll be back with you again next weekend. That'll be episode 859. It'll be right in the middle of the draft because we'll have night one done, but it'll be the day before night two. So I'll get to talk more about the WWE draft, the moves that were made, talk Dark Side of the Ring, and all the other news of the week. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and I will see you back here for more Sound Off later tonight on YouTube and next Sunday for 8:59. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
He walks in, he finds Buff on all fours in his bathtub, buck naked, and his mom is standing behind him and she is shaving his balls for him. Buff turns around and says, oh, hey, buddy. Buff's mom turns around and says, oh, hey, how you doing? Is everything okay? Like it's nothing. Slick says, you people are sick. And he walks out. My mother isn't here anymore. But as I think back to some of the things that I have asked her for over the years. Mom, can you pick me up from the train? Mom, can you take me to the doctor? I'm not feeling well. Mom, can you help me out with the podcast? I can't ever remember the thought crossing my mind to ask, hey, Mom, do you have a few minutes to shave my balls? And if I had, she would have told me, you've got two hands. Shave your own goddamn balls.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster Sounds Off.